Let's call this meeting to order. Members, we don't have a quorum yet, so thank you for those who are here already. Appreciate that. So we'll get started with our hearing. Today we are going to hear from our providers. And so we're going to start out with the long-term care providers. And I think Gail Kleinfeld. I can't say that last name. I'm just bad. You're going to have to collect me. Correct me. Collect me, too. Anyway, this is really getting bad. And Ms. Cullen, please come on up and join us. The worst part is my eldest daughter listens to this late at night. Don't ask me why, but checking on her mother. So I'll get a commentary text about 11 o'clock tonight. Good morning. Will you please identify yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony?
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee. My name is Gail Kvenvold. You actually say all of those consonants. No, Norwegians love their consonants together.
Correct.
I'm the president and CEO of Leading Age Minnesota, and I'm here this morning with my colleague Patty Cullen and several of our respective members from across our two associations. Together, we represent a majority of the providers of older adult services in the state, with services ranging from adult day to in-home services to assisted living and housing with services to skilled nursing care. And together we employ about 100,000 caregivers across the state and touch the lives of an equal number of seniors every day. I want to thank you so much for the opportunity to come before you today and address the issue of protection of vulnerable adults. And I want to begin by saying that we have zero tolerance for the maltreatment of vulnerable adults. And as I said in the Senate Aging Committee last week, abuse of a vulnerable adult or maltreatment in any form strikes really at the core of what we do as providers and caregivers. And we grieve with the seniors and their families whose lives have been impacted by maltreatment. And we offer our apologies and our sympathy. And as importantly, or maybe even more importantly, our heartfelt pledge to do all that we can to prevent abuse or maltreatment before it occurs. The providers you're going to hear from today are people for whom caregiving is a calling, and improving the lives of others is a career choice. And they represent the vast majority of thousands and thousands of dedicated individuals who embrace the responsibility every day to go above and beyond in ensuring the health and safety and well-being of the older adults they serve. But this is truly work that we cannot do alone. And it is in the spirit of working together and in listening to those who have called on us to do better that we're advancing a set of ideas that are focused in three areas: on prevention, on transparency, and on accountability. And as we'll go into some detail on those proposals later this morning, but you will see common ground not only with the recommendations of the legislative auditor yesterday, but a report, by the way, which we support and to which we had input, but also with some of the key recommendations of the governor's task force. Among other things, we were delighted yesterday to see the auditor, legislative auditor, and the commissioner of health call out the opportunity to mine the data from maltreatment reports to identify trends and target interventions to prevent maltreatment before it ever occurs. This opportunity already exists for hospitals in our state, and we welcome the chance to put tools like this at work in senior care. And in the meantime, we have already been working within our associations on best practices and on training for our members to improve safety, including sharing information weekly with our members on the substantiated reports of maltreatment that are posted by OHFC. We also endorse the recommendation of the legislative auditor to establish a legislatively mandated working group to take a holistic look at how we oversee and regulate housing with services, and we'll share with you later this morning recommendations for steps we feel could be taken immediately to address the consumer's call for better communication, for greater transparency, and for oversight. We're really at a watershed moment for how we will ensure quality in senior living settings, particularly assisted living. We created our pioneering framework that we have in Minnesota about 20 years ago now, And at that time, we did ground it in research about what consumers said they wanted as they would grow older. Consumers told us then that they wanted home, their own apartment. They told us that they wanted choices about which services and supports they would buy. And they told us that they wanted to age in place, to the extent possible, to not have to move as their care needs might change and they needed more care or support. And we have seen seniors and others choose these settings in overwhelming numbers. In fact, today we have twice as many people living in housing with services settings as we have living in care centers in our state. But we also recognize that an important change has occurred in our state and that seniors are moving into our assisted living settings later in their life and needing more care and support than was the case 20 years ago, particularly for memory care. And we're committed to working with you and with other stakeholders on changing and strengthening our assisted living framework in ways that hopefully stay true to that vision of person-centered and consumer-directed care delivery while ensuring greater safety and protection. I started my career in this field as a nursing assistant and then spent a decade as a nursing home social worker. And I've had the experience, too, of navigating our really pretty complex long-term care system as the adult child of aging parents. And now here I am, a senior myself. I don't know how that happened, but I feel I have a personal stake, too, in our getting this right. We've passed the 1 million mark in terms of we people over the age of 65, and this work has never been more important or urgent. So on behalf of our provider and our caregiving community, I want to thank you again for hearing our ideas and for recognizing that we are eager to participate in solutions and passionate about improving the future for seniors in our state. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Klenvold. Ms. Cullen, would you like to?
Sure. I have a few additional things to add. Thank you. My name is Patty Cullen. I'm President and CEO of Care Providers of Minnesota, the other trade association representing providers of older adult services in the state. So, first of all, thank you, Madam Chair and committee members, for taking time to hear from us this morning. Thank you, Representative Keel, for agreeing to take on authorship of some of the ideas that will be discussed by our lobbying team a little bit later this morning. As Gail noted before, we are deeply disturbed by the reports that have come. The isolated examples of neglect and abuse noted in the media, noted in the testimony, noting in the stories you have heard, in the reports that you've read, highlighted in the media. So I do echo Gail's apologies as well as concerns for the individual families and seniors who are at the core of what we're working on today. We do think it's important to note that those unacceptable situations that we have zero tolerance for are the minority of occurrences that happen. As rare as they are, we do know that they're deeply personal. So again, for those families, we don't want to negate the importance of looking at those individual situations. On the other hand, we also know, as Gail mentioned, there are 100,000 dedicated caregivers who provide care to over 100,000 seniors each and every day in our care settings. These are caregivers who also have been impacted deeply by these stories. And you'll hear from a few of our representatives today talking about how it makes them feel as caregivers when they read stories about people they consider family being harmed in their settings. They are heartbroken over individual examples, and they find themselves in an interesting position these days at a time, as the OLA report noted, there is a workforce shortage, and we can't deny that that's a critical issue that faces our profession right now. But in a time of workforce shortage, when you have a lot of negative stories that come in the press, they're in a position of defending their careers and what they have chosen as their life passion. And I think we have to acknowledge that that fact is out there as well. We also know, I've heard from some of my members who are spending a lot of extra time soothing family members and tenants and residents that they serve who also hear the stories and who are very concerned about their own safety and their loved one's safety. So we have to also acknowledge the impact on the individual seniors who we're serving today. And so I think that's important to add to the center of this discussion. Ultimately, we are concerned that when you only focus on the minority, it'll have a chilling effect on our ability to get additional workforce and the great caregivers that we need. As Gail noted, we have 1 million seniors now, and that number is growing. We need additional caregivers, not fewer caregivers. We can't afford to let some of these occurrences and the media around these occurrences have a chilling effect on our ability to hire and maintain. So we are hoping that by working together this session on some proactive solutions that we can move forward and talk about prevention and talk about transparency and focus on the good things that can happen out of these negative stories that have occurred. So as Gail noted, we do support and are advocating for a multifaceted effort that looks at prevention, that looks at accountability, that looks at transparency. Those are our key themes. We do want to reduce, as you all do, the number of occurrences of maltreatment that happen. We're not going to get to zero because accidents do happen. We have a very fragile population that we serve each and every day. We're not going to get to zero occurrences, but our goal is to prevent as many as possible. And for those occurrences that do happen, let's learn from them. There are, I get the good and the bad of the stories of this profession. I get the opportunities to present awards to caregivers that have been in this profession for 30 years with hearts of gold who believe deeply that this is family that they are taking care of. But I also read the OHFC report. So there's also individuals out there that shouldn't be providing care to our seniors or, unfortunately, provide really good care and an accident happen. And in the cases where that happens, we should learn from them. So we should, as Gail noted, the issue of prevention is really knowledge about what occurrences are happening right now that we can learn from. We can learn from how medications are being stolen. Let's gather the data and figure out what we can do to prevent medication diversion. We can learn from the kind of falls that happen. Is it tied to a specific type of lift? Is it tied to a tab on a lift? Is it tied to a sling? Is it? Those are the kind of things we frequently see in those reports, and let's learn from them and train our people so that we can prevent further occurrences. So under the banner of prevention, the data is key. There will be some discussion later about the use of cameras, whether they're helpful to prevent or whether it's more of a comfort for family members, and I'll let my staff cover that in a little bit. Accountability, we talked a little bit, Gail mentioned. So there are things related to if people do bad things intentionally, we do want them held accountable, and I think that's important to note. There's a big difference between a nursing assistant who is trying really, really hard and someone fell because she turned to help someone else versus someone who stole their drugs and left them in pain. There's a big difference. And so to the extent we can look at criminal charges for some of the perpetrators, that would be awesome. We have no tolerance for retaliation against reports. We haven't been part of the consumer group discussions at all, so we don't know all of the intentions of that language, but we firmly believe that everyone should be feel free to report when they see it and have no repercussions. So we're supporting of that. Then as Gail also noted, the development of some stakeholder groups that really take a look at some of the issues that during this short session we just don't have the time to address. There is a complicated infrastructure that we have developed, and we acknowledge that. And so we also know that there were some laws that just recently passed on dementia training, and we have no knowledge about how those are going anyway. So let's take a look at some of those and the implications of the laws that just passed and were just implemented on required trainings. And finally, the area of transparency, we concur with the recommendations, as Gail mentioned in the OLA report, because there should be knowledge of reports that are happening. Family members, responsible parties, and that's kind of key. One of the challenges that we have as providers is we need to follow the law and the federal regulations. And so sometimes the wishes of family members who are not responsible parties, who have not been identified to act on behalf of the senior, or seniors who don't want their families involved. That's where the tension comes in. So we are hoping to work through who really has a say in the information about them. I think at the core of it is the senior involved, and then from there there are some restrictions that we have to follow as certified providers that we need to keep at the forefront when we talk about those recommendations. So finally, it's imperative to prioritize all of the policies this session. There are a lot of great ideas out here, and as you know, Madam Chair, members of the committee, you have limited committee time to get all your work done. We are committed to continue to talk through these issues. So to the extent that everything can't be passed this session, we think there are a lot of good ideas and great opportunities for stakeholders together, including regulators and legislators and consumer groups and provider groups, interested parties, to talk through what problems can we solve by just working together on communication, and what things have to come before the legislature for changes to make sure that we address some of the privacy concerns and such. We do hope that the conversations at the rest of this session are collaborative in nature, and we can work together to make sure we can all implement the changes that we need. So thank you for your time, and thank you for your interest and being on this committee, which is key to my future, Gail's future, and many of the people in these rooms who are looking at their loved ones as well. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Cullen. Yes, you point out a very important fact. We are all going to need some type of services sometime. So, yes, it is in our best interest to make sure we get this right. And it's too important not to. So, thank you very much. Members, we have a quorum. So, first of all, we need to approve the minutes for the last two meetings. We'll do that real quickly, and then we can ask questions. First of all, let's go to the February 28th minutes, and Representative Lohmer, would you?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Moves the approval of February 28th minutes. Let's see, where am I at? Are there any additions, corrections, or changes to the minutes? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Minutes are approved. Then we have the March 6th minutes. Representative Olson. Sorry about that. Representative Olson, would you approve the minutes for March 6th meeting?
Yes, Madam Chair, I move the minutes.
Thank you. Are there any additions or corrections or changes? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and the minutes are approved. Thank you, members. Okay. Now, to our testifiers, thank you very much. Do we have any questions, members? Representative Tice?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm on a fact-finding mission, more or less. Being back in the district, you run into folks, and they have issues. And quite frankly, I don't know how to help them. I don't know how to advise them. And so I guess one of the perks of being on the committee is you all come to me. So this is really just information gathering. I did have a family come to me and said, you know, you're doing all this work to keep our parents at home, but we as the family don't think they should be at home. So is there kind of a cheat sheet or like a test they can, you know, kind of say, okay, you got this, or is there somebody that can come in and say, yes, you really should be going someplace else? I know on the driver's side of it, in St. Cloud, we have a training facility for officers, and so you could take your parents there, and they could drive the course, and if they failed, you weren't the one saying, we're taking away your driver's license. So I'm kind of looking for this with keeping our folks at home. Is there something available?
Yeah.
Madam Chair, Representative, the Senior Linkage Line does have a number of good tools available, including real-time people that you can talk to, but also an online assessment for what your needs may be and how that may sync up with services that are available in your part of the state.
And I would add to that, Representative Tice, that the website is minnesotahelp.info, and the Senior Linkage Line, which is run by your area agencies on aging, do long-term care consultations. So you would call in, the family member would call in and describe, and they would kind of lead you down the path that you need. And it's a well-funded, long time in operation. And each region of the state does have an area agency on aging with folks that do that.
Thank you. Representative Tice?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And again, to both of you, this is fact-finding because I guess I really don't know what you do, but I was talking to a gentleman whose cousin is disabled. In fact, she came to visit and do the work a couple of years ago. And she has a caregiver right now who has an alcohol problem and is abusive to the point where she's gone in the hospital. She won't report it. She won't press charges because she doesn't want to leave home. She feels that if she presses charges, they won't give her anybody a new PCA or whatever. She's just going to go to a home. What can family do? I mean, we're not looking at brothers and sisters or moms and dads. We're looking at cousins. What rights do they have to say, you know, you need to press charges. This person needs help. But yet she wants to stay home more than she wants to deal with what's going on. How does a person help her?
Representative Cullen, we are fortunate in that just a few years ago we established the Minnesota Elder Justice Center, and they have now funded caseworker positions. And the role, the niche that they play is the intersection between law enforcement and counties and individuals. And so in that case, because I get those calls as well, care providers in Minnesota, they Google it and they think that's what we do. So we get a lot of calls. I do send folks, families, to the Minnesota Elder Justice Center, and they will talk through their options on charges and what they should be doing. It might be that they call County Adult Protection, because if it's a vulnerable adult, they have a requirement to report it through the county. So that's, you know, one of the thousands of reports that you read about in the OLA. This would be one of them that is sent through the MARC to, you know, to report. But I would probably have sent them to the Minnesota Elder Justice Center.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for being here. This is a good conversation to have, and I think it really you know, is nice to have it in tandem with what we have been hearing with the Office of Facilities Health Complaints and the OLA report to have the providers here. And so I appreciate it, and I know you do good, hard work. And my dad worked in long-term care. He retired from chaplaincy, so has worked in various settings, and I've, because of that, been around a lot of different places. So I appreciate the hard work that you have and that you're doing. You know, and one thing I heard in your testimony, we've had a chance to really dive into the role of MDH and what we need to do, and they're really going full steam ahead on fixing what we've learned. You know, no holds barred, really making sure they're doing what's right. And I think we've heard that in this committee, and we heard it yesterday, and I'm impressed by how seriously they're taking their ownership of this. And I hear you taking ownership, too, and I appreciate that. You know, I did hear a little bit of hesitancy on that going fast part, just due to, you know, laws being complicated and figuring it out and giving it the time it needs. But I was curious, and maybe this will be better for the further testifiers that will get into some of the specifics, but I was actually wondering, there are some really good recommendations that did come out that I do want to see move forward and not just be thought about, because this is where the actual wrongdoing is happening, and we need to stop that. So as seriously as we're taking a government agency owning their responsibility, I hope we take that serious with our providers where the wrongdoing is originating. And one of those things, I was actually at a homeless shelter before I left for session, and happened to, not knowing all of this was going to come in the way it has, ran into someone who had been in an assisted living facility, and due to probably mental health, maybe could have been dementia, I'm not exactly sure, was then at a shelter after being in assisted living. And so one of the things I was happy to see was conversation around discharge. And so I would imagine something like that, we don't necessarily need a stakeholder group to identify when that's already been, I mean, I saw it firsthand. So I was wondering if you could speak to maybe that issue or maybe that's later about some of those things which I feel like we really do need to just get out ahead. If we know that doesn't work in long-term care settings, other settings, I'm just, that shocked me. That absolutely shocked me that that could happen. And so some things like that, that's why I care so much about this, is having had some first-rung experience with that and why I feel like we do have some urgency in it. So if you could speak to a little bit around, or maybe, again, this is for later testifiers, around where there are some good things, that there is some urgency, and specifically this discharge thing feels like I'd love to see some movement on that and hear from your perspective. I'm imagining you have some thoughts on that too. So,
Ms. Glenvold.
Madam Chair, Representative Olson, we will be touching upon that yet this morning. And I would say that there are definitely some things we believe can be done this legislative session, but we also are anxious for a broad working group to come together. As my colleague, Ms. Cullen, mentioned, we weren't part of the initial group that came together to formulate recommendations, nor were some other key stakeholders, such as health plans and other stakeholders across the continuum. So we do think that a broad conversation, I think the legislative auditor used the word holistic, take a holistic look at our regulatory system. But we do believe there are some things that can be done immediately, and we also are looking at things we can do that don't require legislation. I referenced just briefly that we're doing work within our associations on better training, more targeted training, on things we can learn today from some of the maltreatment reports and look to have enhanced information for that effort going forward.
Representative Olson.
Thank you.
Okay. Madam Chair.
Ms. Cullen, go
just
ahead.
Want to add one comment to this. So the issue of mental health has been one that, as a profession, we've been grappling with as well, because we acknowledge that assisted living settings for individuals with mental health may not be the best place, and we're seeing an increasing number of individuals with mental health needs, both in our nursing facilities as well as in our assisted living. We are actually working. We just received notice. We will be working on developing some behavior training videos. We just received some funding to do that, to really short videos to help de-escalation, communication, all of those things, so that we will be better equipped when we find out that our new tenant has mental health issues or our new resident has mental health issues, because we don't know that necessarily when they are admitted into our building. So we are, as Gail mentioned, we are working on that independent of whatever language is put in here on notifications.
Thank you. Representative Olson, do you have another question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that's helpful to know, and I think just the idea that anybody can be discharged or whatever term you want into homelessness is kind of, let's try not to have that happen in any setting, was kind of the point. But thank you. That's super helpful. Thank you to the testifiers.
I think that it is very difficult, too, when you don't know the person until they've arrived and you start to assess and realize, I've seen that happen in memory care, where someone is maybe even violent and having to figure out how to handle them and where they need to be treated best. I'm glad to hear that there's that discussion happening, because staff needs to know how to handle somebody. Very scary when there's residents there and there's a problem. So, yeah. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Chair Keel. A question for Ms. Cullen regarding the Minnesota Elder Justice Center. Mm-hmm. Certainly I can look up the phone number, but if you happen to have it on your contacts and could give that to me now, that'd be great. Otherwise, I'll look for it later. The reason I need that number, I need to find out if this would be the place to call. There's a situation, I won't go into the details, Chair Keel and Representative Tice know about it, in Delano, of a dispute between siblings and their mother. Mm-hmm. And the mother's kind of being held hostage, if you will, in the house, taken advantage of by one of the children who I think is older than I am, who was able to live there and scare the mother to make sure other children don't get to see her. So it's a really nasty issue. I've addressed it here last year, talked to the ombudsman from Hennepin County, because they just live right across the county. Sheriff's been involved, and here it is a year later. I talked to my constituent and friend at the grocery store over Christmas. Still nothing's been done. They don't even go over to the house to visit her mother, who's been abused and in the hospital, and it's a mess. So no one seems to be able to help. It's really it's disheartening. So every once in a while I think of my friend, and I give her a call, hey, has anything been done? Has the ombudsman been able to help? And just lost in a system that is just decomposing. I don't know what better word to use, but it's a nasty system. But now this is the first I've heard of the Minnesota Elder Justice Center. Maybe is this the number? Is this the people that I can have my constituent contact to maybe finally get some resolve that they can see their mother and make sure she's in good health?
Ms. Cullen.
Madam Chair, Representative McDonald, yes, and I can either give you the information after, or the vice chair of the board, Susie Scheller, is here, she is the vice chair of the board for the Minnesota Elder Justice Center, right? Yeah. So yes, we will get you that information.
Thank you. Ms. Kovac-Venvold,
yes.
Did you have a comment?
I did not.
Okay. Thank you. Representative McDonald, okay. Well, any other questions, members? So I thank you both ladies for joining us, and appreciate you spending some time with us, and we're looking forward to any other suggestions that you might come up with. We have, I believe, Ms. Emily Straw from Greenbush here, and I don't know if Kate Collins wants to join her from Duluth. Let's do two at a time. We have two more, so have a seat. And welcome to our committee. Ms. Straw, if you would like to identify yourself for the record, and go ahead and, with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Emily Straw. First, I wanted to start out by thanking you guys for having me, for inviting me today. My name is Emily. I'm the administrator of two skilled nursing facilities in rural Minnesota. Greenbush Manor is a 40-bed skilled nursing facility in Greenbush that is attached to a small clinic and a 12-unit assisted living. Roseau Manor is a 50-bed skilled nursing facility located in Roseau that is attached to a 25-bed critical access hospital. We are located in the northwest corner of the state, bordering North Dakota and Canada. The city of Roseau has a population of approximately 2,300 people, and the city of Greenbush about 800. We compete for labor with many large manufacturing companies like Polaris, Marvin Windows and Doors, and DigiKey. One of our number one challenges is recruiting and retaining sufficient staff. We provide care for many types of people with multiple health complexities, oftentimes who have undesirable symptoms of their disease processes. The work is physically and emotionally draining. We care for challenging residents, and sometimes individuals who work in long-term care do not receive the same level of respect as in other care settings. I started in this industry as a 16-year-old high school student working a part-time job. I was a dietary aide. I worked after school and weekends. I enjoyed working with the residents in our cozy and comfortable environment. I learned that they were oftentimes friends of my grandparents, and I heard stories about my own parents. This was my first work experience, and it led me to my major in healthcare administration. I'm now the administrator of that same small town facility where I started out. There are so many wonderful things happening in nursing homes, and the vast majority of providers work endlessly to provide safe, high-quality care. We are proud of the services and the care we are able to provide for our communities. We take care of our neighbors, our friends, and in some cases, our own family members. Residents and their families' expectations of us have changed over time, as consumers in all industries have changed with the rise of accessible data. Data like our quality indicators, our satisfaction reports, our survey inspection results are readily available to consumers. People ask more questions and expect to be involved and informed. It is in our best interest as providers to ensure that we have satisfied and happy residents and family members, and that we're delivering a service that is oftentimes not what they want to receive. We have good practices in place for preventing, identifying, and reporting abuse. We conduct thorough pre-employment screenings, which include background studies, fingerprints, and reference checks. All new employees are trained on our vulnerable adult policy on day one of employment, which includes the abuse prevention, identification, and recognition of warning signs and reporting abuse. We train on this policy to existing employees at least annually and more often, most of the time. All new employees go through a series of computerized interactive trainings related specifically to taking care of people with dementia. Topics like approaches, communication, and disease processes, specific types of dementia are covered in those trainings. Current employees go through that same course at least annually, and each year when we meet with our planning committee for our education for the year, we try to work with educator partners like the Alzheimer's Association to actually bring out live speakers so that we can rotate the content of what our staff education looks like every year. We are actually in the process of starting a new practice where we will be reviewing the OHFC's released reports of abuse at monthly staff meetings with caregivers so that we can learn from them and we can increase our staff's awareness of what's happening out there. All allegations of abuse are investigated extensively. We interview anyone who may have worked in that location at the time of the alleged incident. We review documentation, care plans, progress notes, and anything that would be considered relevant to the incident. We meet as an interdisciplinary team to review the incident and the findings. We learn from each incident and put steps into place to prevent reoccurrence, which may include things like staff education, disciplinary action, termination, changes to residents, individual plans of care, or policy and procedure changes to our systems or our workflows. Residents are assessed for their risk of vulnerability upon admission and periodically afterwards, and we implement individualized interventions proactively and individually for each resident. We track and monitor our quality indicators and participate in quality initiatives as a part of our quality improvement and performance improvement processes. Over the last several years, many facilities, including my own, have received a failure to report abuse citation by the Department of Health at our annual inspections. The fear of getting this serious deficiency is a huge contribution to the overwhelming increase of abuse reports to the OHFC. This over-reporting has led to a resource allocation issue that we see highlighted in the media today. The most frustrating component of the current reporting system for me is that the facilities are not able to investigate any incident of alleged abuse prior to making the initial report to the OHFC. Upon learning of any allegation that could be abuse, first we must report the incident to the OHFC. Then we can investigate, and then we complete a follow-up report back to the OHFC. In many cases, upon further investigation, we may obtain more information that would support that the case is not abuse or even a reportable incident. But because of the reporting requirement, we're unable to ask further questions until the first report is made. An example might be if a resident reports they are missing $10. This could mean that the money was lost in laundry, the family took it home for safekeeping, or that a resident never actually had the money. Because of its potential for abuse, it's reportable. Upon further investigation, many times the facility can figure out what happened to the money by interviewing staff or family members or searching a room or the laundry department. Time and resources are dedicated to the reporting, written documentation of the incident, and the follow-up report. The last point I want to touch on is the limitations of access to care in rural Minnesota. Reports have talked about when a roommate or another resident is the abuser. In rural Minnesota, we have limited access to mental health services and resources for caring for people with mental health diagnoses, which can oftentimes go hand in hand with the physical and verbal aggression or behaviors that can disrupt other residents. Facilities struggle to meet the needs or find alternative placement for residents who may be disruptive to others. As our population continues to age, we see an increase in these types of situations. Caregivers choose this work because they are called to take care of others. It's not easy work. Working in long-term care is a daily challenge between balancing the residents' rights and autonomy between safety and the rights of other individuals. Please know that as a provider, I take allegations of elder abuse very seriously. I am eager to work together to find ways to prevent abuse and protect our most vulnerable citizens. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Straw, and thank you for your work. I know it's challenging, and just to give the members a little bit of an idea, how far apart in mileage is Greenbush and Roseau?
Greenbush and Roseau are about 20 miles apart.
Okay. I was thinking it was a little more than that, but yeah. Okay. Thank you very much. Before we ask questions, Ms. Collins, would you like to address the committee? Can you state your name and go ahead with your testimony?
Thank you, Madam Chair, representatives. Good morning. I'm Katie Collins. I'm the administrator of Viewcrest Health Center, located in the Piedmont Heights neighborhood of Duluth, just 2.5 hours up the road. I have been in the long-term care business for over 10 years now. I actually started with my internship. I think we went to school together. I went to Morehead State, and I served people with disabilities while I was attending college there. I graduated in 2005 and started an internship at my hospital in Detroit Lakes, my hometown. From there, I was employed by Benedictine Health System for 10 years, specifically licensed as a nursing home administrator from 2008 until the present. I came over to Viewcrest about 2.5 years ago. Viewcrest is a 92-bed skilled nursing facility serving about 85 long-term care folks and then, between 10 and 20 short stay folks that are there for rehab. I also oversee a housing with services facility, an assisted living facility, about 20 miles south of Duluth that has 45 apartment units or serves about 45 individuals. Emily really covered a whole lot. and I guess in my setting and in my experiences, the workforce is definitely a challenge. And to back up maybe to talk about a little bit about who we care for, as Emily had mentioned, the individuals that we care for aren't, the regular grandmas and grandpas that are at home and maybe, shouldn't be driving anymore and maybe, have some COPD or congestive heart failure. We care for individuals that have all of those things and then another 20 diagnoses. We care for some really sick individuals, not only physically, but also battling dementia and mental health issues. Schizophrenia is a common diagnosis in the individuals that we serve, in addition to their physical conditions. So typically, speaking in the assisted living realm of the world, those are where we serve maybe more individuals that Representative Tice was kind of mentioning, individuals that shouldn't be driving anymore, individuals that absolutely need help with medication administration, and likely, bathing, showering, those kinds of things. That's who we care for in assisted living. Nursing homes are individuals that need maybe, everything to be able to live their daily routine, repositioning in bed because they can't do it themselves, assistance with eating, or a pureed food and us assisting them in eating. So just to kind of give you a real good idea of who we're caring for in these settings. So they are incredibly vulnerable. So the employees that we mostly employ at Viewcrest, for instance, we have about 160 employees. Most of them are certified nursing assistants. CNA requires 80 hours of in-classroom and clinical experience in order to obtain their certification. We employ individuals that typically they're about 16 years old all the way until late 60s, early 70s that are certified nursing assistants. And so we have some of our CNAs have 40 years of experience. And to think about, you know, who those people are and who we're recruiting, who our healthcare workers are, they're individuals that are making 12, 13 bucks an hour nowadays. They're individuals that work really hard, not only when they're at work, but also to make ends meet at home. They're often caring for not only their children, but also their parents or family members, extended family, loved ones too. And so, as Gail and Patty had mentioned, and Emily as well, there's thousands of wonderful caregivers that do a wonderful job every day. So it's difficult for us to hear when abuse has occurred in facilities. It's difficult for us to hear of horror stories, actually. And so we obviously take those very seriously. We talk about it. I specifically review our substantiated reports that the state, you know, has or Leading Age releases weekly. And I let my leadership team know. Our leadership team consists of our director of nursing, activities, dietary, nurse managers. And we let them know what kinds of things could happen. Because a lot of us don't even, we wouldn't even think that that kind of abuse could occur if we didn't know that it had occurred in other facilities. So we talk about it so that we're aware and that we can better understand, you know, who we're serving and the kinds of people that we may be working with. Emily talked about the background check system, our fingerprinting, the extensive orientation. You know, we do 2 full days of in-classroom orientation for our new CNAs and staff before they even get to the floor. And then once they're on the floor, they have 8 full days of shadowing with somebody to get to know how things work at Viewcrest, who their residents are, what their residents, because each resident has different preferences, different things that we have to help them with, and really get to know who those residents are that they're caring for. So that's kind of our current process of how we're able to choose and recruit and get someone in and orient them to their work at Viewcrest. And then from there, you know, it's we really kind of check in with our newer employees to make sure that they're doing comfortable, that they're, you know, they don't have any questions for us, that they're doing things the way they should be doing them. We obviously have lots of interactions with our residents, checking in with them, making sure that they're doing well, that they don't have any concerns. Emily mentioned, you know, all of the different kind of pressures that we're under with our different quality metrics, the surveyors, the OHFC investigations, the reports that we need to do. So those types of, you know, prevention of abuse and maltreatment are always at top of mind. But again, you think about the individuals that are coming to us and that are applying for work, because again, the healthcare shortage is huge. We don't take just anybody, you know. We do have standards for individuals, but unfortunately, you can't, you know, necessarily identify somebody right at the gate and say, you know, you've got it. You might abuse someone someday. Drug diversion is huge. It's something that we can improve on our processes and learn, you know, from different industries maybe on how they ensure that medications are always secure. The vulnerability of money or financial exploitation is huge too. But we also have to recognize that our residents are their own person and they make their own decisions, and we have to honor them and their decisions as well. So it's a really big balance. There's likely some things that we can do to improve our ability to better maybe identify and prevent vulnerable adult abuse in our settings. But just know that most of us already try to do everything that we can.
Thank you, Mr. Cullen. Ms. Cullen. I got a question for you. I just, my brain is thinking here. As you talk about drug handling meds, can you address the difference between how you do meds for a nursing home as opposed to assisted living or independent living? Because there's a little bit of a difference, correct?
There is, yep, yeah.
Ms. Cullen, would you go ahead?
Madam Chair, thank you. In the skilled nursing setting, the nursing staff, the licensed nurses, have all the meds. We administer all of the medications. Only a licensed nurse or a trained medication aide administers medications to our residents. In the assisted living setting, the assisted living settings are, there's a variety of different ways that they do it, whereas skilled nursing facilities, all licensed nurses hold onto that medication and administer it, unless it's care planned otherwise. In housing settings, there's a variety, but there are a few controls. For controlled substances, they need to be under two lock, and so a double lock system. For all other medications, though, the tenant is able to store them in their unit. Now, with the progression, like I've been in the business for 10 years, I've seen it progress to where typically the tenant has the medications in their unit, but most of the time it's in that same location in every unit, and it is under lock.
Thank you. Ms. Straw, do you have anything to add to how you handle it?
Yeah.
Okay. All right, thank you. Members, Representative Allen, do you have a question of these ladies?
Yes. The staff that you have that is below licensed, mm-hmm. staff, nurses, could you identify what those positions are? And then as far as, like, what percentage of your workforce for the facilities, and do they are often working double shifts or, and so what the, and so, because they have primary care initially to get the residents up in the morning, and so what are the working conditions for, like, CNAs or?
Yeah.
Ms. Cullen.
Allen.
Sorry.
Representative Allen. Our CNAs, dietary staff, housekeeping staff, they're all unlicensed professionals. You're correct. They make up 80% of our 160 employees, at least. And they are responsible for everything from the residents, you know, waking up in the morning, getting them ready for the day, whatever those care needs might be, whether it be just helping them, you know, getting them set up to brush their teeth and to get their clothes on, or to assist them completely in all of those cares. Then making sure that they're eating, dietary and housekeeping, making sure that their room is clean, the facility is clean, and the activity staff also our unlicensed professionals that that help make their day great every day, all the way through the day, with assistance with toileting, which could mean just, you know, assisting them to sit on the toilet, all the way to checking their briefs and changing them when needed.
Representative Allen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So if there's a shortage, so how common is it for CNAs to be working? Are they mandated to work when somebody calls in sick? And then also, if any of your facilities, or whether there's unions, whether they're unionized?
Ms. Collin.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Allen. We are unionized. We have two unions in our facility. One covers pretty much all of our unlicensed personnel, and the other union covers our licensed nurses, some of our licensed nurses. As far as working double shifts and mandations, there are some, thanks to the 2015 legislation, where we were able to increase the pay and health insurance, be able to pay health insurance and stuff. We've been able to recruit a lot more caregivers to the workforce, which was so beneficial. But there is still a shortage of people, and so I would say, if you're looking for some concrete numbers, our staff. It really ebbs and flows. Sometimes they're working a lot of doubles, and other times they're just working their 2-week schedule. But they are mandated. If nobody has picked up the shift after them, they can't work for more than 16 hours, which is 2 8-hour shifts. We do give them some extra breaks and an hour to take care of personal things such as childcare and that type of thing. They are mandated in Duluth. Like I said, since 2015, since we were able to implement some salary increases for those folks and help with benefits and tuition reimbursements and those types of things, we've been able to hire a lot more caregivers. So I would say that our position on staffing looks a lot better than it did in, say, 2014.
Thank you. Members, we need to move on to, we have two more testifiers. I thank you both for coming and your work that you do, and the little bit of a stretch of a drive. I hope you drive safe and the roads are good. So, but if you're hanging around, there might be some more questions. Appreciate that. Thank you. To the table now, we'll welcome Ms. Nicole Madsen and Gail Sheridan. Thank you, ladies, for coming to join us. And if you would go ahead and identify yourself for the record and where you're from.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members. I'm Nicole Madsen. I am the administrator at Good Samaritan Society Specialty Care in Robbinsdale, Minnesota. I've worked in healthcare for about 29 years. I, similar to Ms. Straw, started out as a dietary aide and kind of worked my way up, which seems to be a consistent story in our industry. We're a specialty care facility in that we serve people that are rehabbing from the hospital to go back to their former living environment, also people with Huntington's disease, men with dementia, and men with behaviors. I was asked to give some information from the provider perspective as it relates to staffing issues, including training, recruitment, retention, and turnover. In regards to training, we prepare our workforce to ensure that we're meeting the needs of our customers. We want to be there to meet the needs that the market is telling us. So training and competency verification is an ongoing effort. We have a systematic approach with an annual training calendar that encompasses an array of topics that are critical to our profession, such as abuse neglect prevention, emergency preparedness, customer service, dementia care,
handling behaviors, Huntington's disease, HIPAA, infection control, bloodborne pathogens, and more hands-on experiential training such as safe resident handling, CPR, LVADs, wound care, IV care, hand hygiene, med administration, to name just a few. Our training is conducted annually, upon hire and then annually thereafter. Each training module also includes a competency verification component, so we're always verifying that somebody has learned what we intended them to learn with the training module. At our facility, because we're a specialty care facility, we also have employed a psychologist for about 20 years to come in one time per week and work with staff exclusively. He tackles topics such as communication, burnout, dealing with borderline personalities, coping with anxiety, and other mental health topics. In regards to recruitment, recruitment for our profession has been a challenge the last few years. As the overall job market has improved, we're competing with non-healthcare related industries for staff, and historically our pay rates have not kept pace with other industries. For jobs like nursing assistants, dietary aides, we're competing with jobs in the fast food or retail industries where starting wages can be as high as $17 per hour. To keep up, we've gotten creative. The Good Samaritan Society employs someone full-time in the metro area to steer candidates our way. Many nursing homes, including ourselves, have cultivated our own career lattices within the organization, like growing our own nurses, engaging with community partners, connecting with students in colleges and high schools, and then also looking to second career folks to round out our workforce. In regards to retention and turnover, our particular facility is blessed with a relatively low turnover rate at 35%, but we're also fortunate to work and live in a major metropolitan area. Many in our industry are faced with higher rates. The American Healthcare Association estimates 63% is the average turnover rate in our state. I know of many providers that are as high as 70 or 85%. This could be indicative of demographic shifts in our community, overall competitiveness in the job market, trends towards lower employment tenure, particularly among younger workers. Estimates indicate that replacement costs for employees can be anywhere from 30 to 400% of the employee's annual salary. And furthermore, we know that consistency in staffing provide for better outcomes for our residents, so we have a vested interest in ensuring that we maintain a low turnover rate. So we strive all we can do to actively engage with our staff. We work with them. We try to know what their future goals are so that we can help them achieve that at the same time while they're working for us. We found when we are a purposeful partner with them, they're more engaged and they stay longer. Lastly, I'd like to give a few examples of some amazing caregivers that I have the privilege to work with. I think of Amy, who's worked for us for over 20 years, similar to myself. She started as a dietary aide, but she had the heart of a true caregiver. She went beyond just serving food. She really enjoyed engaging with her residents, getting to know them, trying to make their day better. I always told her that she would make a good aide or a good nurse. And lo and behold, she did just that. She went back. She got her nursing assistant certificate and her TMA certificate. Started working for us in that capacity, and now she is working towards her nursing degree. And that's a goal that we're helping her achieve through the scholarship reimbursement program. I also think of Mark, who started with us over 12 years ago. Even though he had a four-year biology degree, he had a passion for direct care. He wanted to do something in long-term care. He was one of those people that did anything and everything that we needed. He was a staffing scheduler, but his true passion was nursing. He worked while he went to school, again, a goal that we helped him achieve through the state scholarship sponsor. And now he works for us as a registered nurse clinical manager. Both of these individuals have been successful in their chosen paths because they working in long-term care has provided them a solid foundation on which to build. They know that the resident comes first,
to always know them as a person, not just a diagnosis, and to find ways to engage with them in meaningful ways. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Mattson. Ms. Sheridan, would you like to tell us your name and identify yourself for the record?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Gail Sheridan. I'm the Chief Clinical Operations Officer for Tillwood Senior Living, and I'm also a principal. I started long-term care a long time ago as a nursing assistant. My first facility was a rural Good Sam facility, so it goes back a few years. I spent several years in long-term care, and I also am a veteran, so worked medical in the as a member of the military, and it didn't take me long to figure out where my passion was, and it is definitely serving others and serving our elders. So I've devoted my career and my passion to serving those in need of our services. We serve 17 standalone assisted livings located throughout the state of Minnesota, both metro and rural. We are in Eota, Marshall, Walnut Grove, Winona, Sherburn, Sauk Rapids, St. Michael, Princeton, St. Cloud, Andover, Chaska, Sauk Center, Little Falls, Minneapolis, Fergus Falls, St. Paul, and Edina. In addition, we have 12 skilled facilities, of which 7 of these have attached assisted living. These are in Minneapolis, Woodbury, Grand Meadow, Forest Lake, Tracy, Mabel, Faribault, Inver Grove, Carlstad, and Waite Park, all the way up to the Canadian border, which is Carlstad. So we cover many rural and many metro. Our mission at Tillwood Senior Living is to enrich the lives of those we serve. This includes our residents, tenants, their families, the communities, and our staff. We live our mission every day and have focused on quality improvement through the last several years. My business partner is co-chair of the American Healthcare Association Quality Cabinet. This is a business guy, works on banking relationships, works on reimbursement, and he is now all about quality and co-chairing the National Quality Committee. I am the chair of Care Providers of Minnesota Quality Council. Each of our communities have quality assurance process improvement committees. We, my staff, myself, visit our communities and try to attend these meetings quarterly to assure that there is continued focus that is followed on the areas of improvement identified for that community. Several of our communities through the years have earned either a bronze or silver American Healthcare Association Quality Award, which is based on the Baldrige criteria. This criteria provides a framework to improve performance with sustainable results. We have another program called Enriching Connections, which focuses on the core principles of person-centered care. It is all about those we serve and honoring their individual choices. I also want to share a few comments regarding maltreatment and abuse. Like all of you, I am heartbroken and angry when I think of those who are most vulnerable and most dependent on us suffer from maltreatment or abuse. We as providers have zero tolerance for any form of abuse. And I want to share with you what we do when something bad happens. So a recent example, this is just in the last month, is 18 missing oxycodone. The home health aide notified the director of nursing at 10:30 p.m. at night to report that there were narcotics missing. The director of health services immediately called the executive director, and the investigation began at that moment. So whenever anything bad happens, a missing blanket, missing $10, missing narcotic, that executive director is notified immediately, and the investigation begins. A MARC report was filed, and police were notified. Time frames were constructed by us for each shift, narcotic count to narrow the time frame, review of who had access to these medications, interviews of staff. We have full video coverage throughout our facility in the public areas, and we reviewed all footage to again narrow down. With most incidents, myself and/or our corporate compliance officer, who also is a nurse, is notified and kept informed or participates in the investigation. I participate in most of our narcotic investigations, and this is one that I did. After about a day, we had an individual that we were fairly certain had diverted the narcotics. Police were asked to come as we were going to bring this individual in to interview, and they said no. They did not want the individual to feel like they were being held against their will. We pressed. Later, a detective did come on site and did join in the interview. The individual denied taking any of the missing narcotics, regardless of the time frames we laid out, the accessibility. Even though we had the Cambridge footing, the detective was quite clear that he was very certain this individual did in fact divert. Pressed for a confession and was unable to get that. At the end of the day, the police did not believe there was enough to prosecute this individual. We believe there was enough, and we terminated employment. This employee was about 3 weeks old, passed all of our screening measures, passed all of the criminal background checks. Our screening process is thorough, our policies are sound, and our narcotic counts were completed according to policy and procedure, which is how the diversion was identified. Our medications and our assisted living are stored in individual resident apartments. Their narcotics are locked within those medication-locked cabinets. It would be an individual that has the key, or somebody who is able to gain access to an apartment and maneuver their way into a narcotic box, which is what happened in this case. It is frustrating as a provider, I'm not an attorney, but to know you have so much what I consider evidence and to know it will never go to prosecution. Another case I worked on was a resident who had a fall from a mechanical lift. Thankfully, the resident suffered a minor bruise and no significant injuries. We had several x-rays done, and she had no injuries. She routinely took Tylenol. She required no extra Tylenol. In fact, following the fall, she proceeded on to dinner and enjoyed her evening activities, and there was no impact on her daily life. The incident was reported to the state through the online system. The nursing assistants were interviewed immediately following the incident, and this included reenactment of the incident. So whenever there is an incident, whether it's a bruise or a skin tear or a fall, as we gather the data and these two individuals, we have them reenact individually. Show us you walked into the room, where was the resident, and how did you secure that resident for the lift. This helps us get to the root cause of what may have gone wrong, and in this case, it identified the aides failed to cross the straps across the legs. This failure is what caused the resident to fall from the mechanical lift. Both aides had been trained. Both were in very good standing. They were devastated when this fall occurred and were very emotionally upset. Per our policy, pending investigation, they were both suspended at that time. Once we had identified the cause of the fall, which was within an hour with the help of these two aides, the facility initiated what is called a mitigation plan. They retrained all of their nursing staff in the facility, and this is a nursing staff of somewhere between 160 to 175 employees. And retraining started that night, that shift. With any employee working, they needed to go through the retraining of the mechanical lift and use of the slings. And this was called a mitigation plan. This continued shift to shift until all nursing staff were retrained over the next 5 days. This is a significant investment of labor time but necessary to keep our residents safe and enables us to learn from our mistakes. Per our policy, this employee, both of these employees in good standing, were given a final written warning. OHFC investigated the fall. The facility was cited with harm, and the nursing assistants were charged with neglect. We as providers work diligently to prevent abuse. We do this through education, monitoring of staff, processes, quality monitoring, engagement with our residents, tenants, families, and staff. We teach and preach full transparency and to always do right for those we serve. Sometimes bad things happen that are not what most of us think is abuse. Some are accidents and some are mistakes, but most all are reported under our system. At all times, though, we have zero tolerance for abuse and maltreatment, and we strive for improvement and will continue to work with others to prevent any abuse from occurring. In closing, there are a significant number of caregivers that work very hard every day to care for individuals who depend on us. The two aides who failed to crisscross the leg straps are good caregivers, and they made a significant mistake. And for that, they were charged with neglect and may never be able to work in health care again. I don't believe this is what our system intended. We have challenges in our settings and certainly staffing challenges, but we are committed to faithfully work for continued improvement and to remain vigilant on prevention and identification of abuse and maltreatment. Thank you.
Thank you very much. excuse me. Obviously demonstrates the challenges we have ahead of us to try and examine how we are treating our elders in this case, but vulnerable adults that need unique services, and that our staff is held accountable when needs to be, but not such a severe punishment when something wasn't done deliberately. I personally have an experience with a family member that someone got hurt, and my aunt got hurt, and staff was... I was there shortly after, so I have just happened to be around and saw all of the details, and it was pretty devastating for the person who had unintentionally... We never did really quite figure out why she broke her leg, but, yeah, it was challenging. So something we need to remember. Excuse me, members. We have just a little bit left. We have three more testifiers. Do we have any brief questions for these two gals? Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a brief question for anyone. In Ms. Straw's testimony, was I mistaken when she said that even in a small issue like a $10 was missing, that they had to report it to Merck or the office of the OFHC first before initiating that investigation? Was I incorrect in hearing that?
That is, in fact, what she said, yes.
Is that state law then, Madam Chair? Does the staff, is that the law that they must report the incident, no matter what level, before they can actually start an investigation or even a question?
Go ahead.
Madam Chair, members, yes, that's true. You must report before you investigate. So you don't know the facts yet. You have to report it first if it's potentially abuse or neglect.
Madam Chair, just a quick follow-up. I know we're
against time. Representative McDonald, yeah.
In that case, then, we saw the auditor's report yesterday at HHS, but I don't recall we looked into it. What time period goes by by the time the report to Merck or whomever, then when you actually can investigate? Is it just reporting, and then you can investigate, or do you have to wait for a response from the office of the OFHC?
Madam Chair,
Ms. Mattson.
I believe you report, and then it's 5 days later that you submit a written report. Back, our reporting is OHFC, not Mark.
Right. And
so the final report is 5 days later.
Okay. Ms. Sheridan?
Madam Chair, the investigation starts immediately and the reporting. So you are reporting, you investigate immediately, and you have 5 days to complete your written report and your investigation and conclusion and submit that to OHFC.
And some of this is dependent on the facility we're talking about, correct? how you report it, how you handle it. Assisted living over nursing home, over memory care, there's some different rules here. Part of our complication in what the OLA suggested yesterday. Did you have a comment, Ms. Sheridan?
Madam Chair, there's really no difference in reporting regarding memory care.
Okay.
There are different mechanisms for assisted living and OHFC, but they are very similar. But what is reported is a little bit different in time frames. Yeah.
Okay. We got to get going. Representative Freiberg.
Just a quick comment. I just wanted to thank you both for coming. I know driving from Robbinsdale is not quite the same thing as driving from Greenbush, but it's never easy to get across town in the morning. A few of us did visit the Good Samaritan Society. A few members of this committee did visit the Good Samaritan Society a year or two ago, and it was an instructive visit. So just wanted to say thanks for coming.
Thank you.
Yes, I appreciate the uniqueness of our facilities. Everyone offers just a little bit different needs, and that's, I appreciate that. Thank you both for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Messerly, are you going to come join us? And before you identify yourself for the record, members, this is instructive in talking about the fact that we're dealing with not just facilities that are separate, but that also we have some jurisdiction over home care and the challenges there. So welcome to the committee and identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the subcommittee. My name is Kathy Messerly, and I'm the Executive Director for the Minnesota Home Care Association. We're an association of providers of health care and support services that are provided in the home. These services are delivered in homes to Minnesotans in every part of the state that are recovering, have disabilities, are chronically or terminally ill. Their needs may be medical, nursing, social, therapeutic treatment, and or just the assistance with their essential activities of daily living. I know you've heard a lot of excellent testimony already, and there's more to come, so I'm going to keep my comments short, but we appreciate the opportunity to share with you. The Home Care Association and our member home care providers have zero tolerance for client abuse. The providers in the community have been taking a more proactive approach to the initial assessments so that they can identify the potential areas of abuse or maltreatment in potential clients' homes. Our members are very supportive of the reportings of suspicions of abuse, neglect, exploitation, and we are heartbroken over the reports of abuse that have occurred with our seniors. Our association has been closely monitoring the discussions around vulnerable adults, and we support the recommendations that are coming from the long-term care imperative. As I mentioned earlier, we strongly support zero tolerance for client abuse, and that includes seniors and others because our members provide care to those that are pediatrics through death. It is our belief that there are opportunities for improving the regulatory enforcement without significantly driving up the cost or reducing access to home care. For example, it has been gratifying to hear the progress that is being made with the process improvement over at OHFC. We believe it would be wise to focus on ensuring the existing laws that are designed to protect home care clients, their families, and providers are being enforced. An example of that would be timely surveys of the home care agencies. Lastly, we thank you for engaging providers in the discussions related to program integrity and enforcement. Home care providers provide dignified cares that are so necessary to those so vulnerable, and we truly want to be a part of the solution. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Messerly. Does anyone have a question for home care? Okay. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.
And finally, we'll welcome Toby Pearson and Carrie Thurlow to the testifying table. If you would like to join us and identify yourself for the record.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members. My name is Toby Pearson. I'm with Care Providers of Minnesota, Also with me today is Ms. Carrie Thurlow from Leading H. As you've heard before, our two associations work together as the long-term care imperative. The Minnesota legislature should work with all stakeholders to reform our regulatory system and provide the tools caregivers need to prevent abuse before it happens. Our goal is to work collectively to prevent abuse, increase transparency, and move towards greater accountability. With those goals in mind, I will outline a couple of areas where we will have proposals this year, and they are first steps that can be taken during 2018. I will then turn it over to Ms. Thurlow, who will further outline more things that we will be bringing during this session. First, I'd like to touch on electronic monitoring, as it's been a topic of much discussion around the Capitol. We recognize remote electronic monitoring may play a role in preventing and/or identifying abuse, neglect, and other forms of maltreatment, and in holding perpetrators accountable. However, we must also keep in mind that residents and clients have a fundamental privacy rights, and providers have an important role to play in protecting those rights. We recommend updating the Minnesota law to address the use of remote electronic monitoring in senior care settings. There are a couple topics that I would like to touch on real briefly as far as what we think are concerns in that electronic monitoring area. First, identifying who the legal representative is. Since these people are vulnerable adults, making sure that we have legal representatives who may be speaking for them or with them is an important topic. Making sure that that legal representative be an appointed guardian or other representative with legal authority to make decisions about health care services for the resident, including a health care agent or an attorney in fact, is of paramount importance. Another concern is consent. We would have consent form prescribed by the commissioner that must be in writing. This consent is up to the resident. And if the resident is unable to have consent as determined by a physician, then a legal representative may help in that consent with the certain processes involved. Another component is the consent of others. A roommate, for example, if it's applicable. Again, this consent should be in writing. If there are new roommates, then the new roommate should consent as well. Individual roommates' consent must be able to be withdrawn at any time, and that must be communicated to the providers. The facility should receive notice of the electronic monitoring prior to the use of the electronic monitoring. This serves a couple purposes. First, since the provider is required under the Bill of Rights to protect the individual's privacy, the provider knows that it's okay with the individual. Second, it would also, if the goal is prevention, serve as a deterrent if everybody knows that there's going to be a camera in there. Finally, it would make the providers aware of any restrictions that the resident or the roommate may have. For example, no broadcasting, only audio, only video, turning it off at certain times, for example, healthcare examinations, dressing or bathing, visiting with a spiritual advisor, are all times that the resident may not want a camera recording or transmitting that information. The cost of the installation should also be addressed. Notice to visitors so that folks who come into the facility know that security cameras and audio devices may be present. And there should be rules prohibiting tampering with, hampering, or obstructing the camera if the device is installed appropriately. There should further be rules about access and dissemination of the video and the appropriate consent and accountability of admissibility as evidence. Easy for me to say. The installer should be a mandated reporter so that if they do catch something on the video, it should be reported to the appropriate entity right away. The goal is to catch it quickly or prevent it from happening. Finally, there should be resident protections that say the facility shall not refuse to admit potential residents or remove residents because they want to have electronic monitoring. The facility cannot intentionally retaliate or discriminate against any resident for electronic monitoring, nor should the facility be able to prevent the installation for those who have provided notice and consent. To summarize, we support electronic monitoring legislation that requires written consent of the client, resident, and patient being recorded, as well as any roommate sharing the living space when appropriate, with such consent required to be shared with the licensed healthcare provider prior to initiation of the remote electronic monitoring, and we recommend that anyone conducting remote electronic monitoring should be categorically considered a mandated reporter under the Vulnerable Adults Act. The second area I'd like to discuss real quickly is criminal code. We believe that there should be a working group established to take a closer look at crimes against vulnerable adults. This group should include a broad array of stakeholders, including city attorneys, county attorneys, public safety, judicial, others, to review the existing laws to make sure that they are identifying appropriately the crimes and applying the appropriate penalties. And then they should come back and recommend any changes. With that, I will turn it over to Ms. Thurlow to go through another set of our proposals.
Thank you. Ms. Thurlow?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Again, for the record, my name is Carrie Thurlow. I'm the Senior Vice President of Advocacy at Leading Age Minnesota and here on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative. Madam Chair, I want to first start by thanking you for holding this hearing and by drawing attention to these issues. Clearly, they're complex, multifaceted, and will require all of us working together to really address these issues, focusing really with three goals in mind: on prevention, on increased transparency, and on increased accountability. As Ms. Kvenvold and Ms. Collins said at the start of this presentation, we believe that there is a lot we can do this session to address many of the issues that have been raised in the media, by the AARP work group, and by the OLA. And in addition to the two issues that Mr. Pearson talked about, I want to touch on a number of solutions that have been addressed in legislation that was introduced earlier this week, and I want to thank Chair Keel for introducing that legislation. One area that we believe that we can work together on that we've heard loud and clear is to strengthen the state laws with regard to anti-retaliation. We have current laws on the books right now that prohibit retaliation against a family member or a patient if a report is being made or if rights are being asserted. But we believe that we can clarify and make those laws consistent, including clarifying and strengthening language in the Home Care Bill of Rights and making that clear. You've also heard us say a number of times that the home care survey process can be strengthened. We believe that surveying regularly home care agencies, those are the service providers in assisted living settings that really deliver the services, are our first line of defense to ensure compliance that can prevent something from becoming a maltreatment issue. And we would propose that there are two ways we can strengthen our survey process. First, by moving up the timeline for new providers operating under a temporary licensure, by ensuring that they are surveyed within the first 90 days of providing home care services to make sure that we're really taking care of any issues right at the start. And then in the instance of a new license being issued under a change of ownership situation, ensuring that those surveys occur within the first 6 months. So, again, getting out when there are new owners. We believe that that would be a positive step forward. You've heard a lot about our focus on prevention efforts, and we believe that we can work together and partner with a wide group of stakeholders to systematize and improve our prevention efforts that are already occurring at the local level right now. And so we are proposing a quality and safety improvement technical panel that would include experts from nonprofit quality improvement and safety, patient safety organizations, the Department of Health, the University of Minnesota, as well as providers, to make regular recommendations and to analyze current data trends to inform prevention and education efforts back to the providers' facilities. We've proposed that we need better, if you were privy to the hearing yesterday and yesterday's joint committee meeting with OLA, you know that we can do a better job at mining the data that exists in OHFC complaints. And we would propose that there is better guidance in legislation to ensure that that information is shared back with providers, and also clarifying within the OHFC investigatory process when information can be shared back throughout the investigation. We've heard that that is an issue loud and clear. There have been calls for a number of additional reforms in the area of assisted living licensure, with regard to memory care standards, and we would say that we support the OLA's recommendation that a comprehensive working group be established with a broad array of stakeholders to address these issues, to look at how we can improve our assisted living regulatory framework and how we can strengthen and clarify requirements for those that hold themselves out and provide that specific care for those with dementia care needs. The long-term care imperative is also proposing that we begin the work on an assisted living report card. And so we are also proposing a work group that would come together to identify a common set of quality metrics for assisted living settings that would be commonly reported so that consumers are able to make informed choices of where to receive care. There's a lot of details in those proposals, and we know that those proposals will be making a lot of committee stops and getting more information. But again, that's just a brief overview of several of the policy recommendations we have. We'd be happy to answer any questions and look forward to the conversation throughout the legislative session.
Thank you, Ms. Thurlow. Members, do you have any questions for either Representative McDonald?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a question for Mr. Pearson. In your testimony, did you say that you believe the state should legislate and pass laws that would mandate electronic monitoring in all facilities?
No, we wouldn't. I'm sorry, Madam Chair, Representative McDonald. We would not mandate that it be in all the facilities, but we would allow it in all the facilities.
Excellent.
Representative McDonald. Okay. Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In the recommendations, and I think it came up a couple of times in various small ways today around housing with services, assisted living, and just I think it came up in one of the testifiers, Ms. Collins or Ms. Straw earlier about, you know, there's a lot of clarity around nursing home and long-term care in some ways, and, you know, we're talking about regulatory and you're talking about a work group to do that. But what is your feeling and what is your sense right now that you know, we still need to dig further into the idea that we do need, from what I've read and seen and understood and talked to, like, we have some sense that there is a need there to have further clarifications around some of that. Are you seeing that, hearing that, understanding that to be the case, or do you feel like we still need to dig deeper into that problem? You know, I'd love to hear just a little bit of talk in specifically that area.
Ms. Thurlow?
Madam Chair, Representative Olson, thank you for the question. We agree that there should be a comprehensive discussion around the framework on how we regulate housing with services. And that is why we are calling for a broad stakeholder group with very clear areas that should be discussed and coming back with recommendations to address a number of the questions that have been raised in that area. As Ms. Kevenvold said at the beginning of this hearing, we set forth years ago to create a housing with services framework that really optimizes consumer choice and was distinctly different than the highly regulated system that we have on the nursing home side in terms of limiting consumer choice and flexibility and all of that. And so we agree that there is you know, work to be done to make sure that in light of the more complex consumers that we are serving in housing with services, that we should look at that framework. But it is a very intricate discussion that impacts a number of areas outside of regulation, for example, Medicaid eligibility for those services to receive eligibility. And so we believe that the right step forward is consistent with the OLA report to create that work group and develop, come back with recommendations next year.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And that's helpful just to understand a little bit more. And again, I think it sounds like a broken record in some of these committees too about, you know, we've identified a pretty big problem and we've really unearthed it, and I'm eager to get going on some of the solution-focused pieces of this. And I know that, you know, as I look to have an aging parent who has I provide care for at times and other family members do, that we've actually started the conversation, and I visited some assisted living facilities with her over the summer and understand that there is urgency in having some clarification of what is shown to me in a brochure and what I can actually expect to see delivered from my mother, and hearing that from other constituents in my district. So I feel some urgency, but I appreciate that you're willing to look in that and have those conversations. So thank you.
Okay. Any other members have questions? I guess we're up against the clock, too. So I thank you very much for your testimony. And members, I want to remind you that next week we are meeting on Wednesday, the 14th. And from that, we will hear from all the consumer groups, as well as the governor's report, excuse me. So we will hear the recommendations for that. So if you have any questions, certainly encourage you to get that prepared. And at the rate we're going, March 14th, I believe, will be our last hearing in aging and long-term care. From there, we will carry the work forward to health and human services policy. So you all know the map. Anyway, thank you very much, and meeting adjourned.